Session number 3866, reel number 2.
Mr. Peroni, Reel 2, you were telling me about that man's face falling when he learnt you were in the black shirts.
Yes.
What sort of reaction did different people have when they knew that about you?
The great bulk didn't pass any comment at all. As long as I didn't thrust my politics down their throat, I think they agreed not to thrust theirs down mine. So there was no reaction from the bulk of people. There was a certain interest from people with strong political interests, but I think often they would say, well, here's a young lad of 19 I was at the time. And they thought, well, on the grounds of youth, we would excuse him his beliefs.
What did your family think?
I think the only marked reaction they had was to worry in case I was physically attacked myself as a result of going to the meetings. They had no political views themselves whatsoever, and they didn't really comprehend the ideas that interested me at the time. As I said earlier, they were so involved in making a living that there was little time to develop their own intellectual interests. And that was a most marked feature of their life.
Even though the British Union of Fascists was a political party, I always think of it, perhaps because of the uniform, in a military sort of context. Did you have any military drill?
No, there was certainly no drill all the time that I was in the British Union of Fascists. No drill whatsoever, but I believe that when it was founded, there was a place down Chelsea called the Black House. And when Sir Oswald Mosley was forming his groups to protect his meetings, there was a certain amount of drill at the Black House, but that must have been only for a limited period of time. Because when there was support generally from people in various areas, then there was no need for special people to protect the meetings, because there were so many volunteers who were willing to act as stewards for meetings.
Did you have any training in, say, crowd handling to be a steward?
No, none at all. None at all. No, you just went there, and if there was no violence, if there was no disorder, well, then of course there was obviously no trouble. In the event of a meeting being attacked, then of course I think the natural reaction of any group of men would be to slog back. And but it was all terribly haphazard, and some people did suffer very severe injuries, no doubt about it. A great degree of violence at the meetings. I remember, and it wasn't only directed against the fascists, it was also directed against the police, who were identified as being friends of the fascists, which was absolute nonsense. But it was quite a common feature at a large meeting, when the police horses were brought in, that tin cans full of marbles will be thrown along the road so that these horses could slip over on the marbles. And so anybody who went along with a can of marbles, That was a premeditated act. You don't suddenly acquire a can of marbles. Injuries could be very severe, broken limbs, smashed noses, faces, some of the big fights. Fortunately, I never seemed to get involved in any fights, and I never had to hit anybody. Nobody attacked me, so I didn't attack anybody. So I was, greatly to my mother's relief, no doubt, I was never hurt at any meeting.
Sir Oswald himself, of course, was quite badly hurt.
Yes, in fact, he was stoned at Liverpool. There's photographs, of course, in the back issues of newspapers, showing him talking on top of a van at Liverpool, being stoned, and subsequently going to hospital with concussion. And that was just one episode where attacks were made on him, but probably that was one of the most successful attacks from the point of view of his assailant, because normally he was surrounded by people who just wanted to be near him, whether there was a fight or not.
Of course, it's appalling that people should be injured, but it seems it was quite useful and expedient that there were fights from the point of view of gaining publicity and perhaps spreading information about the British Union of Fascists.
Oh yes, undoubtedly I think it was the excitement of the major meetings that created an upswell of support in the period from, shall we say, 33 to 39 was the period where Moseley's meetings was the major force for building up support for his political ideas. But as Moseley himself, I think, would be the first to say, he would often go into a town and hold a big rally, Glasgow, Birmingham, Manchester, and there would appear to be a tremendous upswell of support. But when he suddenly went away, that collapsed. In other words, a lot of the support was publicity support. It wasn't genuine support insofar as people would say, yes, now let's get down and create an organisation for this party and let's build it up in the locality. Certain areas were, but I would be inclined to say that they were very few and far between. The media, to a great extent, made Moseley, as well as Moseley's own personal contribution as an outstanding politician of the 20th century. If he hadn't had the media, then I doubt if he would have been detained during the Second World War.
Though he presumably also wouldn't have succeeded as much as he did.
Well, certainly the media, because it reported the excitement of the meetings, attracted other people to the meetings who subsequently divided off left or right. And therefore, the success he gained was contributed to by the media. Oh yes, certainly.
It seems there might be a problem here, a danger, in that with this excitement and publicity, you might bring people to the Union who weren't really people that were thoughtful politically at all, people that you would want to join, but who just went along for the excitement.
Oh, absolutely. I think this is very true of football today, that there are people who go along not because they enjoy football, which is the primary purpose of an assembly, but because it presents a situation where they can find excitement, danger, and the possibility of punching somebody, which is a pleasure for that type of person. And undoubtedly, British Union attracted the type of person to a limited degree, I would say, and from my personal experience, quite a minimal limited degree too, of individuals who were really thugs. In other words, they wanted to hurt somebody. And certainly the in Hampstead, Hampstead's not a sort of area that can attract that type of person. And certainly not from the BUF. I can't remember anybody. But as I said, the British Union of Fascists in Hampstead was a relatively small in numbers. And I can remember far more people of artistic talents and sensibilities who were members in those days who belonged to the British Union of Fascists than anybody who looked remotely like a thug.
Was there any effort made at, say, branch level to tactfully or otherwise drop people who were interested but who seemed to you were perhaps just thugs?
Well, as that problem didn't arise in Hampstead, I wouldn't know. Whether it arose in other branches, I couldn't answer, of course, for that at all. I just wouldn't know. I would imagine that if there was an intelligent district leader in a given constituency, and if he was interested in building up his own organisation, he wouldn't want to have in it people whose presence would adversely affect his own interest in building up his area. So, but I think in the East End, of course, where you got a lot of crowd support, often you got people attaching themselves not to a branch, not in so far as taking out membership, but they would come along to a rally in the East End, and if there was a fight, they would glory in it, because that was their mode of existence, you see. So you would get hangers-on who would come along, but of course they would make a point of going to the mass rallies, where of course there's quite often street fights.
While we're on this subject, could you tell me about some of the types of people who were members? I mean, within your own experience, in your local group, and people you were contacted with.
Yes, I remember.
I get the impression of quite a cross-section.
Oh, yes, I would say it's very British Union, locally, regionally and nationally, I would say, was a very much a cross-section of society in Britain as a whole. And when I say society, I mean the general populace, because you did have a whole variety of people. There was a very distinguished photographer in this area called Edwin Smith, who he's dead now, but he and his wife were in the Hampstead branch, and he was a most artistic man, but very young in those days. And I remember he was so taken up with photography that he used to photograph his little son in every situation that you could see a baby in. Waking up in the morning, going to bed at night, sitting on the potty, having his food, sleep in the pram. He was shooting, in photographic terms, this child all the time. So he had an immense record of the baby's growth, first 4 years, certainly. And then later on, of course, he published, or he contributed as a photographer, to the publication of many books on English cathedrals, abbeys. And he became a very distinguished man later on in life, long after he had left behind the British Union days of his youth. He was one person that comes to mind. There was a man, not in Hampstead, but I subsequently got to know, who had the first musical typewriter that I ever came across. And when I say musical typewriter, the keys, instead of being alphabetical characters, were notation keys. So you could actually type music. And that struck me as an extremely rare object to come across. Or it was for me, anyway. You've got the very famous author, now dead. I went to his memorial service last year, Henry Williamson, the author of Tarka, the Otter, Salar, the Salmon, a man of great artistic sensibility. He was a person at the Earl's Court meeting of 1939, there was about 20,000 people in that hall, and I think in Picture Post at the time there was a record, and it mentioned some of the people, quite celebrated people in different ways of life, who were supporting Mosley at that time. And that was 3 years after the Public Order Act had been introduced. And in fact, in the year war broke out, Mosley had the biggest meeting he had ever held.
And were there other people with a background more similar to yours?
To a certain extent, yes, but I think one's more interested in the celebrity rather than in the person who does an everyday task like oneself.
Yes, though it might be false to give an impression that there were only well-known celebrities.
Oh, certainly not. But it's a question of what the other type. Well, I've mentioned, you see, the Daricots. They had their own business. They were stamp dealers. There was Edwin Smith, photographer, artist, developing as a young man. Let me see. I can't recollect anybody who stood out in my mind, because I didn't really spend much time, as far as I can recollect, in asking them what their occupations were or things like that. I'm afraid my memory on that side is very weak indeed, and it's weak merely because I can't recollect in detail what the sort of occupations were of the fellow members. No. I met my wife, of course, in the British Union Fascist. She had joined before I joined, and as a young man of 19, you pay considerable interest in the physical appearance of the opposite sex. And I remember I'd sort of graded the physical appearance of the ladies I came across at the British Union of Fascists in Hampstead in 1936, and my wife was rated number two. Now, she was a typist and had worked in a solicitor's office, and I should think to some extent she probably represented quite a number of girls who were attracted to doing just ordinary everyday jobs. Mm. But because they're ordinary and everyday, nobody discusses them at any great length. You just accept it.
What sort of role was there for women in black shirts?
Well, selling the paper. There was great interest in building up women's reputation and emphasising what contribution women could make more than they were to society. And there were one or two women who wrote for Action and wrote specifically for a female audience rather than for a male audience. And but whether it was the male or the female, there was always very dominant the patriotic motivation, whether it was a woman or a man, that came through on what they said, how they behaved, and what they thought and what they read. They were very, very single-minded about Britain. They regarded that if Britain wasn't number one, Britain should have been number one. That was their attitude.
Did the violence attract or repel women from joining?
Well, to a certain extent, I think that Mosley was a very romantic figure. And undoubtedly that he alone attracted a lot of women to join the British Union of Fascists. To a certain extent, I suppose that you'd also get a number of girls saying, here's a lot of men, I'll go where a lot of men are, you see, rather than saying, well, here's a lot of women, I'll go where a lot of women are. And so I suppose that was a motivating force too for a number of girls. But on the other hand, there must have been a number of girls, just as much as there are a number of boys, who were interested in the issues of the time and really were attracted by Mosley's ideas that came out through his various publications and hammered home at his various speeches. But just as much as the people were a cross-section of society, so were their own personal ideas.
What sort of moral code did the British Union have towards relationships between the men and women?
Moral code? Well, I think if there was any thought of moral code, and looking back, I can't ever recollect myself morality being a prime feature of Union, the British Union's comments on society. General respect for women, I would say that. And like today, for instance, if anybody in those times had tried to foster the idea of people living together rather than being married, they would have been regarded very much as outsiders of their time. So marriage and family, of course, and looking after children were things which people took for granted. But I don't think this was peculiar to British Union. This is what society as a whole felt like in those days. To a certain extent, anybody who offended the code of the times would have been regarded as a bit of an outcast. And no doubt, and people did suffer then, very much so. A girl who became pregnant before marriage would have to hide her head in shame 40 years ago, you see. So there's been a rapid transformation.
On the morale of the British Union, of the Public Order Act, and particularly perhaps the banning of the uniform?
To my recollection, it wasn't as damaging an effect as the proposers of the Public Order Act thought it would be. And I think this is demonstrated by the fact that 3 years after the uniforms were banned, Mosley was able to hold his biggest ever meeting. And if it hadn't have been for the war, it may well have been that 3 years after that he would have had an even bigger meeting. So this really demonstrates that the uniform had really served its purpose at the end of 1936, because it had been the medium of attracting people for one reason or another, and in many cases personal reasons, why they should join that political party rather than the others that were on offer. The Public Order Act itself didn't stop the growth of British Union. It was developing a momentum of its own, but of course in 1939 and even earlier there was this apprehension that war would come, and Mosley took very strong, firm stand for a negotiated peace when war did break out. But he made every possible effort as a politician to prevent war breaking out by word of mouth. And because of the apprehension of war, there was a swell, a public swell of opinion for a party that was speaking out very markedly against war. So I can't remember at the end of 1936 or 1937 anybody dropping out on the grounds, well, I haven't got a uniform so I don't want to belong. No, people wore black shirts, that is a shirt proper, but a black one instead of a grey one or a blue one or a red one, under a suit with a black tie, perhaps an indirect way, but even so, the bulk of the people didn't want to wear that type of shirt. They wanted to wear a blue shirt or a yellow shirt or what. And so even that was only limited to a few people. So really, the banning of the black shirt, I would say, had little, if any, effect on Mosley's politics or the support that those politics got.
What was the effect of the arrest of Mosley?
Well, that happened on the 23rd of May 1940. Hitler had struck in the West on May the 10th, if I recollect rightly. And therefore, the arrest of Mosley had nothing like the impact it would have had if he had been arrested on May the 1st. You see, because people's minds were dominated by this swiftly changing pattern of events where the Low Countries had been overcome very rapidly. After all, they'd remember Poland had gone in 3 weeks and then Norway had been invaded and one after the other. When Hitler struck, everything was so rapid that as soon as a newspaper was printed, it was out of date right away. And so although Mosley's arrest obviously was of importance to the people who wanted to see him arrested, on the one hand, but to the people who supported his ideas, on the other. I would say that small gatherings went on, but meetings proper really collapsed with the arrest of Mosley on the 23rd of May 1940.